This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Tuesday, March 19th, 2024. I'm Caleb Brown. What's the value of war games? Certainly, military officials use them to train personnel, but they are also supposed to help militaries understand weaknesses, guide policy, and decide where future resources should be devoted. Economist Garrett Wood has explored the value of wargaming. We discussed how war games are used and how they might be abused.
We're constantly trying to come up with maps of reality. And we're often told the map is not the territory. And so when we're modeling something like a reality with a game, we have to take some liberties in designing the game, right? It can't be perfect. It's not lived experience. It's different. The stakes are different. The incentives may be different. We want them to be substantially the same. So explain to me, what do military officials and, you know, more, I guess, civilian leaders in governments, what do they see as the enduring value of wargaming?
I think you get two answers to that question. The first is probably the one that your typical layman thinks of, which is we put in the data. We had experts, warriors, you know, military scholars and whatnot, look at the data and run through a number of scenarios, a number of strategies, test different tactics. And through all this testing, we've come up with an idea of how we should fight, what weapons we should buy, where we should fight, when, etc. That is, the game is being used to guide policy. That's one way to look at war games. The other way to look at war games, and I think this is a minority view, but it's the one I come down in favor of, is just as an intuition training device, almost the same way that chess is. You might hope that your military leaders are good at chess because you imagine the game developing strategic forethought and a concept of how to move around in clever ways that minimize your own losses and impose your will on the opponent. So you've got these two competing ways of viewing war games. They're either producing hard, reliable data about what conflict is going to be like, and then that can guide your procurement process, or they're just ways to help us train better, more tactically and strategically savvy officers. And the problem that crops up is not just that there's a conflict between these visions of what the games do. The problem that crops up is the ones that you mentioned. The game is not reality. You try to get the incentives right, but you don't always, for reasons we can discuss. And you try to get the information right, and you don't always, for reasons we can discuss.
To what extent are there differences among particular government officials about why we're doing this? Why are we engaged in this war game? Is it to make plans? Is it to train our people to handle certain situations? Is it just to get the budget right when it's time to spend money?
So it's kind of all of the above. I think that for the people who wind up making the decisions about war games, a lot of this really does come down to budget. And that includes, obviously, DOD writ large, but in particular, the services themselves. If they're going to run a war game, you can imagine that they're not going to publish the results or they're going to skew the results if it makes a suggestion that would impact their budget. They don't want their budgets to shrink. That's DOD, that's Army, that's Air Force, that's Navy. It doesn't matter who. And it's sub-communities as well. It's tankers, it's naval aviators, it's drone pilots, etc., right? Congress, likewise, not that eager for the budget to shrink. Obviously, military procurement provides a lot of jobs in a lot of different districts. So if the services come to them, being the experts in military affairs, and say that we ran a war game and we need more bombers or we need more aircraft carriers, well, there's two problems. One, Congress is not really in a position to question their expertise very effectively because they're congressmen. They're not soldiers. They're not sailors. You know, they don't have that expertise. And the other is they don't really have an incentive to, because they would like more aircraft carriers to be produced so long as it's being produced in their district. And this is the problem that we see with war games. It's both that information problem and the incentive problem. Anytime you've got an expert that knows more about their craft than you do, you've got to worry about how they might manipulate the information that they give you in order to get, you know, favors or a bigger budget or whatever else. And this is something we see in the paper, right? There are a number of games that are played in order to prove that you shouldn't cut DOD budget. One that comes to mind was the follow-on to Nimble Dancer, which is a war game called Dynamic Commitment. It's run a couple years after this one war game that's set to prove that DOD can handle two simultaneous wars. And when the question comes up in Congress, hey, we've got some inkling that the first war game you ran that was supposed to prove this point may have been skewed or rigged in certain ways. So we'd like you to do it again, and we'd like you to do it with reduced force levels. We want you to test what budget cuts would look like on your ability to win two different wars. They say, sure. They go and they run the game. And the way that they test the cuts is for each branch, for each service, to suffer 10%, 20%, or 30% cuts just across the board. If you go and you read some reports, particularly from GAO, so there's another government institution we could talk about that maybe has some different incentives than the other ones. But if you go and you read their reports on how this game was run, they point out correctly that testing just across the board flat cuts like that is unrealistic. In reality, you would look for weapon systems or communities or branches that could take a heavier hit without losing that ability to fight two wars. But since it's DOD running the game, and since DOD is composed of the people who would be facing the cuts, the only way that you can get them to agree to run a game like that is if there's buy-in from each service, and the only way to get that buy-in is for everybody to split the pain in such an unrealistically even way that it makes it impossible for Congress to propose those cuts.
It really goes to what my former colleague Ben Friedman used to say here at the Cato Institute, that there is sort of a gentleman's agreement among the branches of the armed services that, yeah, sure, why not? Everybody gets an F-35, or that's just sort of how it's been. And you don't have necessarily individual branches in the Pentagon trying to eat each other's lunch.
Not as much as you might hope. There's discussion in the literature about, you know, whether or not jointness promotes competition and effective defense production, or whether it kills it. To Friedman's point, if everybody's getting an F-35, then you really don't have to compete. The way that the services has kind of figured out how to limit competition between each other, which is dangerous for them, the way that they limit it is to just in unison push bigger and bigger budgets so that everybody can get everything that they want, which is something I'm looking into for another paper. But when you do see that kind of competition between services, it, you know, produces interesting results. Another one of the games mentioned in this paper comes out of the 60s. I think it's something to the effect of strategic arms and force or something to that effect. Anyways, the Air Force runs this game for the better part of a decade to try to predict whether or not and how much the U.S. and the Soviet Union are going to increase their stock of land-based ICBMs. And in a vacuum, you would expect that the stock would go up, that that would be the focal point, especially in a Cold War that centers around, you know, nuclear competition. But since this is run by the Air Force and not by the Navy, and since the Air Force doesn't really want to talk to the Navy about this, perhaps because they want a particular result, they get the prediction wrong. What wound up happening in the real world is that both sides invested heavily in submarine-based ballistic missile technologies. So just by excluding one branch, perhaps to get a certain result that that initial branch running the game favored, just by excluding a branch with particular knowledge about different missile technologies, you get a game that looks nothing like the real world. And it's a game that would have been used to make real-world recommendations to Congress about what we should invest in. And this is kind of the whole problem with war games, right? If you're using them as predictive tools and as budget guides, you're going to run into problems. If you just take a step back and use it as an intuition training device, as a way to bring up new military leaders, you're less likely to suffer that problem.
I wonder if there are, and I believe we've talked about this before, making the process of war gaming more dynamic, which is to say, maybe there's a prize at the end for the individual gamer who's able to win the game, to pull a Kobayashi Maru, to borrow a phrase from Star Trek.
Sure. So there are some of those incentives that get discussed in this paper, and it really kind of boils down to three, right? A, you might be worried about the prestige of the military. So if you run a game showing that they're going to lose, especially to, you know, let's say an insurgency, right? And we've had war games that predicted actually with pretty high fidelity how the Vietnam War would go. That game was run during the Vietnam War. And we've had games that predicted more or less how our wars, recent wars in the Middle East would go. And they had pretty high fidelity, right? But that's embarrassing. That does not look good for the military. That might be the kind of result that you would like to suppress. And they do get suppressed. There was a trend for decades where the Navy was aware that their aircraft carriers didn't perform well in war games. They'd get snuck up on and sunk by enemy submarines, for instance. And the result is just suppressed. A, it's embarrassing, but B, also consider the community of professionals within the military, so naval aviators and surface warfare officers who operate on those ships. And on top of that, the economic interests, the shipyards that produce those ships. Neither of them want to see that result come out. It would obviously hurt their careers in a pretty tangible way. And so the Navy buries those results for a while. In fact, that really only becomes apparent, I think, with Millennium Challenge 2002, which is a fascinating thing to go read about. And that was somebody being so frustrated with the game being rigged so extensively that they decided to leak the results to the press. So you've got the kind of prestige incentives, you've got the very tangible career incentives, and then you've got incentives, you know, in terms of promotion. If there's no war going on, then how do you determine who your good officers are? And there's a number of margins, but one of them would almost have to be war games. How do they perform under as much stress as we can simulate? And, you know, to the extent that you only get promoted if you do well in a war game, you may want to rig it. Or the people who are mentoring you may want to rig it for you. All of those are possibilities.
Garrett Wood is a professor of economics at Virginia Wesleyan University. We spoke earlier this month. Subscribe to and rate the Cato Daily podcast wherever you please. Thank you for listening.